Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager.
And in this episode, we're talking about a little book series, a little TV show, a little franchise known as The Strain.
Yeah, so this is something that Guillermo del Toro originally came out with as a series of novels with Chuck Hogan. Mm-hmm. And it is primarily, you know, we're going to try not to spoil this story for anybody during this episode. It's primarily about vampires, but they have a very particular kind of biology that's unique to this story. So what we were thinking was that we could take a look at that and how it relates to the biology of actual parasites and vampire-like creatures in nature.
Yeah, it's kind of in the same vein with some past episodes we've done with Monster of the Week, blog series, Monster Science video series, that sort of thing. And, you know, I know some of you out there love The Strain. Some of you out there may hate The Strain. And a number of you have no idea what we're talking about, perhaps.
Right.
And maybe you'll end up checking some of it out because of this episode. But we're going to use the show. We're going to use the books, which you've read, but I have not.
I've read the books, and I've read the comics, mm-hmm. and I've watched the first season.
Okay. And I've watched the first and second season up until like this
right
recording
where
date.
Yeah, right, it's where it's at now.
Yeah, so we're not gonna get into spoilers related what happens to characters in the book or on mm-hmm. the TV show. We are going to discuss the biology of the fictional creature so as to discuss real world comparisons, but that's about it. So if you want to enter into the show just 100% purist, unspoiled, then I guess you should skip this episode and come back to it later. But for the most part, you don't have to worry.
Yeah, so for the most part, what we're going to do is stick to the biology of these things. And I think a good place to start is with Del Toro himself. So if you're not familiar with his movies, Del Toro is, I think it's fair to call him a horror mastermind, or at least he's considered one.
Yeah.
He's done movies about vampires before. He's done fantasy kind of fairy tale movies, movies about demons. He's very into the gothic horror supernatural genre. He's also done some stuff that isn't supernatural though, right? I feel like.
Has he? I don't know that he has. I feel like even his, you know, he has his two types of films. He has the more personal artsy films and then the bigger budget stuff.
But yeah.
they all seem to have monsters in them. If he has a monster-free film out there, I am totally forgetting it.
Yeah, I am too. Maybe I'm wrong on this, but yeah. So the first two vampire movies that he worked on, though, the first one was Kronos, which is what, like 20 years old at this point.
Yeah, that was his first feature film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he also directed the classic Blade 2.
Ah, which I love.
I'm a fan as well. And there is a particular kind of vampire in both of these that sort of we can look back to as the, you know, vampire for Del Toro's Vampires in the Strain. Before we get into that, I think it's really interesting. There's a quote by him where he talks about why he was interested in creating the show in the first place. And he said that since he was a little kid, he's always kept a notebook full of ideas about vampire mutations, biology, sociology, and mythology. So this is just something he's been thinking about since he was a child. He knows, you know, he put some of it in Kronos, he put some of it in Blade, but he really wanted the Strain to be like his opus on vampires.
Yeah. He really get that from these properties, you know, like whatever failings there might be regarding, you know, the main characters in this or that, or the plot or the narrative. You can't fault the monsters because the man loves his monsters, and it's clear the amount of work he puts into it, the people that he brings in to design. Like, he's always bringing in such a fantastic team of artists. And I understand he sets up when he's developing any of these properties, he sets up in the middle of the art department. Like, it's not another room. He's there in the middle of it saying, that's great. That's great.
I believe that's his background, is that he worked in television, I want to say, in Spanish language television, as like an art director before he started directing and writing himself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, have you ever looked at, they may even have published a version of this, of his notebooks.
Yes, I've seen.
They're fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like each project he works on, he just fills a notebook with drawings and little writings and scribblings. And he's an amazing artist as well. Mm-hmm. So you get to see kind of his ideas for how these things flesh out.
Literally flesh out, because he's really into the
yes,
the
he
flesh
is.
But I mean, he seems like there's always a monster autopsy scene in any film he does, which is perfect.
Absolutely, and he has seriously got an obsession with jaws and mandibles and tongues, like pretty much everything. I remember watching Pacific Rim, which is that's the last major feature that he came out with.
I believe so.
And even the giant monsters in that, the kaiju, had these like mandibles that separated off of their face and these huge tongues that shot out. He's really into that.
Yeah, I believe on most of his recent films, he's brought in Wayne Barlow as one of the artists.
Yeah.
Of course, his work designing alien physiologies and demonic physiologies, all based on a background that he and his parents had in natural world illustrations.
This is Wayne Barlow, not Del Toro.
Yeah. But Wayne Barlow's work is just so, I mean, you believe any design that he gives you. It feels like a real fleshy creature that you've just never witnessed before.
Yeah, so his team that he works with, that he's kind of he's assembled this like A-team over the years of working on projects, but Wayne Barlow is a mainstay. And then another guy who I'm a fan of is Guy Davis, who is a comic book illustrator who's worked on stuff like the BPRD, his own book, The Marquee, and he did a really interesting, one of his first comics was like a punk rock take on Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes was a woman in the 70s who was a punk rocker.
Nice.
It was fascinating. It's good stuff. But Guy is also just an amazing concept artist, and so he's designed monsters as well along with that team with Wayne. And then looking at the research that we had for this episode, there were two guys in particular that seemed to work with them on the actual special effects and makeup. It was Steve Newburn and Sean Sansom are the team on the at least the first season of The Strain. They were responsible for a lot of the practical special effects.
Now, just to go back to Kronos and Blade 2 for a second. In Kronos, we saw vampirism as this kind of hybrid of an, you know, alchemical insect clockwork contraption. That was pretty interesting. Like, it kind of pins to you, sinks its teeth in, and begins the transformation.
Yeah, I had actually forgotten the main plot of that movie because it's been so long since I've seen it. So I reread the summary before we came into the studio, and it really immediately came back to me that what stuck with me was the aesthetic imagery of that clockwork bug thing, you know, piercing people more, and also the like sort of marble-ish white translucent skin
of
the vampire.
Yeah, that definitely stuck with me, and that's something he came back to in Blade 2 as well for the elder vampire in that, where you have this ancient creature that is, you know, at once beautiful and ghastly, that it's taken on this Nosferatu appearance, but it also has the look of like a marbled statue. So it's that kind of dichotomy that I feel like he captures really well in his
creatures. He does a great job, you know, this is pop culture talk, not science talk, but he does a great job of honoring the sort of lineage of vampire stories and incorporating aspects of Nosferatu or Dracula into these things, but also putting his own spin on it by adding weird science, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yes, yes. The Reapers in Blade 2, which are like the bad new strain of vampires that are even closer to what we see in the strain. They have these cool mandible jaws that open, like the jaw, the lower jaw splits down the middle and becomes mandibles, and then there's a proboscis type tongue that comes out to pump out blood. And my favorite bit, which I think I mentioned in the Stigmata episode, is that they have hardened bone plating on front and back, so the only way to stab them in the heart is to go in through the side.
Yeah, like under the armpit,
Where you get into this, into the, of course, the Catholic imagery that, that Del Toro is really into as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note, too, this is also part of the strain in a number of his designs, I suppose, but there's definitely a vagina dentata theme going on with his vampire monsters and that, like, their monster mouths kind of open up and have teeth in a way that, like, the vagina dentata mythology, I think, represents.
Yeah, I remember listening to the Blade 2 director's commentary.
Oh, I have not heard that.
A while back, because, like I say, I really loved that movie when it came out, and it's one of those I could probably watch any time. But I remember Del Toro pointing to, like, different scenes and saying, yes, that door kind of looks like a vagina. This doorway kind of looks like a vagina. So he was like that, Catholicism and monsters, that's his thing.
Did you ever see the third one?
Yes.
Because in the third one, I think they took it, didn't they take his model? He did not direct it, but they took his model and like applied it to a Pomeranian dog. Right?
Yeah, it kind of has a cameo with a Pomeranian.
Yeah.
Just to mock you with how great the second one was.
Yeah. So, all right, basically this is how we're going to play this out. We'll present to you how the vampires in the strain are biologically formed, how their fictional biology works, and then the second part of this episode, we're going to talk about Strigoi, which is what they call them in the series, in the natural world. So everything from wasps to creepy worms, syphilis, you name it. We're going to try to cover it.
Excellent. All right, so let's do it. Let's dissect the Strigoi here. Do you want to take us through this?
Yeah, I will try. So he definitely has thought out from beginning to end a process through which these things go through. And it all starts with a worm, this kind of capillary worm that passes from one creature to another. And in the case of the vampires, they, you know, they bleed the worms or, you know, when they drink the blood of their victims, they pass the worms on to their victims.
Or they might vomit it into your face.
Yeah. Is there one or two of those as well? Yeah. I mean, it can really happen like any way that, like, even if you like touch, I think, like spilled blood by one of these things, there's worms in it that'll burrow into your skin. Right?
Yeah. They're always like wiping off their swords because they end up with, you know, that ichor on them with little worms.
So this worm is essentially responsible for the whole fictional biology of these vampires. And the way that it works is you get infected by one of them, you lie in a suspended state of animation for about a day, and then the following night you rise as a vampire. And so it's not like the idea of the vampire from sort of past fiction where it kills the victim, they die, they're buried, and then they rise. These people are still alive. They're just undergoing like a metamorphosis.
Yeah. Yeah. Like definitely it's a situation where the parasite transforms the host into really a different kind of organism.
And the primary thing, like I think the first thing in these vampires' biology that changes is they grow a 6-foot-long stinger out of their mouth that fills up their torso cavity. And I guess what's supposed to happen is the lungs and the throat tissue all kind of like melt down and recompose and modify into this stinger thing.
And it's hideously long too.
Yeah. And it is how they feed. They shoot it out of their mouths and latch onto people. Or they also, that's how they pass on worms to other people to spread the infection. And like we mentioned with the mandibles of the Blade 2 vampires, their jaws are on this weird lower hinge and they kind of, you know, drop so that the stinger has room to come out of. And that, I think, in the storylines, at least from my experience with the books and the comics, I think it takes, like, that's the first thing, like within 8 hours, you've got a stinger. Mm-hmm. And you might still have a little bit of your personality, but then it takes 7 days for this other set of traits to change within your body. So, your skin becomes opaque, your digestive system gets fused together, the stinger forms, of course, you lose your hair and your fingernails and your nose and also your genitals and ears. So the vampires are sexless kind of, they're very machine-like in a lot mm-hmm. of ways, right? They just kind of dump all of the, non-essentials of the human body. And then their fingers grow into talon-like things, which I don't know if they use them as weapons as much as they do for, like, crawling around on walls and stuff, right?
Yeah, I think in the show you do see them use less as weapons because, I mean, they got that stinger, right? Why would you even have to use your claws?
So the idea then is that, you know, after 7 nights, they're fully formed into these sort of hairless, white, stinger beasts that troll around and, you know, kill humans and turn them into more vampires.
And most of them are kind of zombie-like, opposed to the very few who have, like a rational mind still in their possession.
Within the fictional world, I'd say, like, there's only like two or three maybe vampires that have sort of, control individuality. Mm-hmm. The rest of them sort of turn into this hive mind of almost like insects, actually. Yeah. So there are a couple of ways that they used science, or they tried to use science. It's kind of hokey pseudoscience.
Sometimes when fiction meets science, you have to build the bridge a little bit between it.
And I think this is the best part about the strain too. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of attention put into this, but. So the mythology of vampires being vulnerable to silver, that's because silver has an antiviral bacterial quality that disinfects these worms and is somehow able to sort of burn through the tissue that they've created. And then they're also vulnerable to UV light, which is where they can't go into sunlight thing comes from, because the UV light also has germicidal properties. It's on a certain kind of wavelength that breaks down the tissue within the vampire bodies. Mm-hmm. This is an interesting sort of sciencey thing that Del Toro threw into there. So his vampires can't vomit.
Okay.
And all of their waste is excreted from a cloaca, they lose their genitals and everything fuses down there into a cloaca. And, their waste is all just ammonia spray, which they usually emit while they're eating. So, like, while they're drinking the blood of their victims, they're also spraying ammonia out behind them. And he based this on ticks. Because apparently ticks have no space inside of their bodies for the food that they eat. So when, like, a tick is on you and it's drinking your blood, this is all from Del Toro. I didn't do tick research for this episode. But he says that they spray out their waste as they're drinking.
Huh. You know, that reminds me. I was reading about scorpions recently. Or actually, it was a really cool article about the anus and the evolution of the anus.
Yeah.
And they mentioned a particular type of scorpion that can jettison its tail when threatened, much like a lizard.
Really?
Yeah, Ottotami. And in this case, though, when they jettison their tail, they also jettison their anus.
Huh.
So they can no longer defecate at that point, so they just continue to balloon up with feces for the rest of their life.
And then die from it eventually? There's a toxic?
Huh.
Only here on Stuff to Blow Your Mind will you go from anus to scorpion to vampire.
I do want to throw in real quick that another interesting vampire myth tidbit that they employ in the strain is the whole vampires cannot cross moving water of their own volition.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
which they never really flesh out because it's kind of more of a magical idea. But I think it's at least hinted that this might have to do with like the evolutionary history of the worm, that like something in the worm abhors moving water.
There is, I don't want to spoil it for our listeners or for you, but there is a explanation to it that comes in the third book, I want to say, and maybe, you know, I guess if the TV show is a season for every book, it would probably be in the third season.
Okay. Well, I have that to look forward to.
Yeah, there is a sort of explanation. I don't think it's sciencey, though. But okay. I like your idea better.
Yeah, because as we'll end up exploring, you know, water, moving water, parasites, and parasitic manipulation of the host.
Hugely important.
Hugely important, yeah. We do see that in the real world.
So Del Toro himself has said in interviews that he based these worms in the strain on two real worms. The first one is the heartworm, which we're all familiar with if you have a pet, if you have a dog. I just gave my dog his heartworm pill this morning. And it, you know, it's a worm that lodges itself in the heart of dogs. It's not a thing that you want. And then the other is an old friend of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, the horsehair worm.
Oh, yes. We did a video about this a while back. And I'll link to it on the landing page.
It is, I gotta say, this episode was a little tough for me to research. I really feel like I've gotten my badge of Stuff to Blow Your Mind courage this week because, there is some pretty disgusting stuff in the biology of these different parasites and insects. And just watching the video of the horsehair worm squirm its way out of a cricket's body is it just gives me goosebumps. It's chilling, but it's also fascinating. I definitely recommend that you go watch that video because I had not heard of it before you did that episode.
Yeah, that was one. I think I mentioned it in the episode that I saw it in like a junior high band class where some girl.
You saw a real one?
Yeah, yeah. Like there was a cricket on the floor and this girl in the clarinet section, she was acting like all, you know, grossed out by it. Uh-huh. And then she stomped the cricket, which I thought was a little over the top.
Yeah.
But then in perfect karma, she was then legitimately horrified by the sight of the horsehair worm emerging, you know, impossibly long from the belly of the cricket and crawling across the band room floor. So,
yeah, they are. I mean, a lot of these things that we're about to talk about are pretty vile. And I'd like to quote. There was an article that I read for this episode that was about the strain, and it was the only other thing I could find that was like this episode. It was about the strain and the science behind parasites. And the science writer at Vox, her name is Susanna Locke. She was the expert that they spoke to about these. And she had this quote in this that I really liked. She said, "For as creepy as you can make some monster, there are almost certainly 10 or 11 things out there in nature that are even creepier," which is, that's nice. I like that. And she's right. It's, there's just something about these things that just are revolting.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing I find again and again with my, Monster of the Week, and Monster Science series is that, like, sometimes I approach it by, like, there's a cool article that comes out, and I'm like, oh, that's some neat biology. I wonder what that matches up with in fictional monsters. But then other times, it's just, if you think of any elaborate monster, if you watch a film and you say, hey, that's a really cool monster design, and then you wonder, is there something in the real world that matches up or exceeds that? There almost always is.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's where the imagination probably comes from in the first place.
Oh, yeah.
Del Toro himself, you know, we mentioned earlier about how he was obsessed with vampires as a little kid. Well, he also refers to himself as a biologically perverse guy. And he said when he was a kid that he's always keeping jars of things, like jars of animals and blood, and he had little dissection tables, so he would just do his own little autopsies on animals, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
And just makes me think of that that old adage that, you know, the kind of people who torture, I mean, he was not torturing animals, but, you know, opening up animals as little kids are probably going to grow up to be a psychopath. Instead, he grew up to be an artistic genius.
That's right. Keep financing his films or else.
Yeah, this episode is not financed by Crimson Peak coming to a theater soon near you.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O, allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
One last thing before we get into the examples. There was another great piece of research that we found that was actually Susanna Locke's article led to it. A guy named Ed Yong did a TED Talk about parasites and the kind of zombie-ish effects that they can have on various animals. Mostly insects, but cats are covered as well. And he says, I think this is part of what makes parasites so sinister and compelling. We place a premium on our free will and our independence, we being humans. And that the prospect of losing those qualities to forces unseen informs many of our deepest societal fears. So this gets right to the heart of what scared me the most about vampires when I was a child. I very clearly remember my first interaction with vampire fiction was an episode of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. And Dracula was the villain that they fought in that episode. And something happened where His Amazing Friends, Firestar, I believe, was his female superhero friend. She was turned into a vampire. And I was probably like four or five, and I remember like doing that thing where you stand by the door and you're watching the TV with one eye around the corner of the door because I was so scared of this cartoon Dracula.
That's weird that Dracula himself showed up because what's the name of the actual vampire that is in like kind of the Blade Marvel?
Oh, Morbius, the living vampire.
Yeah,
I don't know if he ever showed up in the cartoon, but Marvel.
Not the old one, right? You're talking about that really old Spider-Man cartoon?
Yeah, the one from the 80s.
Oh, okay.
This one, there was an older Spider-Man cartoon, I believe, in the late 60s, early 70s. But Marvel had a string of horror comics that came out in the 70s, and Dracula was one of them.
Okay.
I think probably because I would assume the rights to that were open, and they could just do whatever they wanted with it.
Cool. Well, I like that quote from Jung, though, because the whole issue of parasites and free will, the whole idea of vampires and free will, certainly resonates, because in vampires you often see themes of addiction are explored, themes of disease, mm-hmm. themes of parasites, all things that suddenly turn the table on us and say, well, maybe we are not in control of our bodies.
Yeah.
If our bodies are telling us to drink this and making these things happen to ourselves. You know?
Some stories have gone so far as to make it a metaphor for like HIV, for instance.
Yeah.
Like it's a bloodborne disease, and it changes our bodies against our will. We don't have any control over it. Yeah. That idea is, I think, inherently revolting, especially to human beings, and maybe specifically to Americans. I don't know. There might be a cultural study on that, but we value our independence so highly in mm-hmm. our culture that maybe there's something to that that affects us more.
Well, you know, and that brings us to syphilis.
Mm.
We're not going to go too in-depth on syphilis because we have two episodes in the past that we did on syphilis, looking at syphilis as a disease, looking at the Treponema pallidum, the organism that causes syphilis, as well as the history and cultural impact of it. But just to refresh, Treponema pallidum, it is a thin, tightly coiled spirochete, this little worm creature that causes syphilis. It's sexually transmitted, and the illness spread through Europe from the mid-15th century onward. And before the advent of antibiotics, it was one of the most common infections, afflicting up to 10% of the adult population in the Western world. And it was incurable for 4.5 centuries. And when you really start teasing apart the impact of syphilis in the Western world, it's difficult to overstate it. It was widespread. It spread. Again, it was incurable. It was a thing to be feared. And of course, as we've been discussing, when we take our monsters, when we create monsters, we're giving our fears a form and face and a force all their own.
Yeah, I think that it's important to recall like how prevalent syphilis was at a time before we were alive, and that I imagine from what I've read of the period that it was most active was that. I say most active as if it was like a living, you know, one single-minded creature, but it was really had a huge impact on the cultural zeitgeist, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, people were in fear of it, and there was also a sort of disgust towards those who had contracted it.
Yeah, because it was, I mean, you know, in the past, pretty much any illness or physical ailment is tied to the soul, but certainly with syphilis, because it, of course, is tied to sexual contact.
Right.
And not exclusively sexual contact. There's also congenital syphilis in which you're just born with it.
Yeah. But there is an assumption in a lot of cases, you know, if you found out that somebody had syphilis, you assumed that they got it from, you know, loose sexual practices.
Right.
And like I remember doing research for another project about the Franklin expedition going through the Northwest Passage. This is in the mid-1800s. And, you know, there were members on board those ships who certainly had syphilis, you know, and the officers looked upon them as being, you know, less than because they had contracted such a thing.
So it's this thing that's spread from one person to another, and it has these various stages. And I'm not going to go into the first two stages, but the later stage, tertiary syphilis, which occurs in 10 to 20 years after the initial infection. So, you know, quite a lot of time passes. And there are a number of symptoms that it involves. We're talking about tissue damage, muscle damage, organ damage, coordination problems, paralysis, numbness, gradual blindness, dementia, death. But where it really ties in nicely with the strain, not only, you know, the worms, of course, causing everything, mm-hmm. but you would often see with syphilis the loss of the nose or the sinking of the nose into what was called saddle nose. And this is where we saw increased use of wigs, the increased use of cosmetics, and the increased use of fake noses to cover up your own essentially decaying nose.
Yeah, this is ironic because just yesterday I was reading a piece that you had previously written on the Stuff to Blow Your Mind site mm-hmm. on stufftoblowyourmind.com about fake noses, artificial noses as prosthetics because of syphilis, but also there were other people like the famous scientist or astronomer Tycho Brahe
who
had his nose cut off in a sword fight, and I believe he wore a gold nose.
Yeah, I think he had a couple, but yeah, I think he had a like a brass or gold nose. At any rate, he replaced his nose, but was not shy about it. He just made it gaudy.
No, he was very brash. He made it as obvious as possible.
Yeah, kind of like Humpty Hump, I think. But in the strain, you see these characters that have been degraded into these Nosferatu-esque characters by mm-hmm. the parasite. They still have to interact with the world, some of them. And in those cases, what do they have to do? They have to put on wigs. They have to put on cosmetics. They have to put on a fake nose, all in order to appear normal again. Also, you would see syphilis sufferers who would use cod pieces. This is also where we saw a resurgence of cod pieces, you saw an increased use of them due to a potential damage to the genitalia.
Well, maybe that's why some rock stars wear cod pieces.
There you go. I think
that's a holdover from syphilis days.
It could be. It could be. And according to Slavic and comparative literature professor Tomislav Longevich, commentators have often drawn a line of comparison between hereditary syphilis and vampirism, because one of the things that you see with the congenital syphilis is the formation of sharp, pointy teeth, which are known as Hutchinson's teeth.
Okay.
So it's the deformations of the gums and teeth. You sometimes see long nails. You see elongated skulls. And superficially, it's easy to look at extreme cases of late syphilis and congenital syphilis, because when you have congenital syphilis, a lot of times the physical deformities are really, they're taking place in the womb and they're pretty severe early on in life. But you could easily make a comparison between Count Orlok in Nosferatu and
sure.
a severe syphilis sufferer.
Yeah, I remember the research that I had done on syphilis, about the sort of Arctic expedition mm-hmm. time. Some of the photos that I saw of skulls or they had done like molds of people's heads. I mean, we're talking like Elephant Man style deformations here.
It's pretty rough.
It looked incredibly painful. And this is a side note about syphilis. I don't know if you've heard this before, but here's a little tidbit fun fact. There's a theory that Leon Czolgosz, who was the man who assassinated President McKinley, mm-hmm. that he possibly had been infected with syphilis and was in second stage heading into third stage syphilis, and that it was part of the disease acting upon his mind that made him go mad and try to kill the president.
Given the time period there, it seems very likely.
I mean, yeah. It's possible. His nose didn't fall off. He hadn't started turning into, mm-hmm. A deformed third tertiary stage syphilis victim. But there's some evidence people think that points in that direction.
Yeah, there are people that argue that Bram Stoker may himself have suffered from syphilis, and that the novel Dracula is or was his own way of exploring his own syphilitic condition. But there's not any hard proof in that area.
So I feel like we've gotten syphilis pretty well covered here. And like you said, there's two previous episodes all about it. So if you want to learn more about syphilis, go back through the archives and certainly take the deep dive with Robert and Julie on that. Let's get to another one. This is just one that that guy Yong mentioned in his TED Talk. He talked mm-hmm. about the guinea worm. Is this one that you've encountered in your various travels with parasites and monsters?
I feel like we've covered guinea worm in the past, yeah.
Okay.
I think I could be wrong on this, but I think we did a something with the Carter Center about Kenny Warren.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that would make sense, actually, given the work that mm-hmm. they do, because apparently the way that you are infected by these is from unclean drinking water. Mm-hmm. And the community that I live in, a suburb just outside of Atlanta here, our water went off for 3 days last week. I don't think guinea worms were what people were worried about, but unclean drinking water was certainly on everybody's mind. We realized sort of how privileged our first world society yeah. is. But yeah, so you are infected by this thing, and then what happens is it creates a burning blister on either your leg or your ankle. So, well, I guess your ankle is your leg. And that what happens is it hurts so much and it burns that your inclination is to immediately go to the water. So here we go. This ties into the sort of vampire can't cross the water type thing.
Yeah. And also parasites, twisting your behavior, mm-hmm. manipulating you to do things.
Exactly. Right. Like, was it your idea to do this? Did the parasite consciously say, I need to make this host of mine walk towards the river? But what happens is people go toward the water. They try to wash the blister. And what happens is the worm bursts out because they can only mate in water. So it immediately bursts out of your skin and moves on. And then, you know, more, I assume they must be microscopic in size when you're drinking them from the unclean water.
Mm-hmm.
More produced. But then let's get on. This is the big daddy monster parasite that really connects to, you know, this Del Toro strigoi, the horsehair worm. We just mentioned it briefly earlier, but let's really investigate this thing.
Yeah, we mentioned if you look at any videos of this, it generally consists of some sort of an insect that's been squashed or it's near the water. And there's this enormous black worm that looks like a thick horse hair, you know, just long,
yeah.
black, doesn't have any other distinguishable features, extremely long, extremely wiggly, just writhing and emerging from this creature's abdomen. And it's grotesque beautiful. And
yeah, you're right. It's both of those things. If you haven't seen it, I think it's important to note, like, these things are like 3 or 4 times the size of their host body in
yeah.
terms of, like, length.
Yeah, once
so
they've reached full size.
When you see
yeah.
them start pouring out of, like, a dead cricket or whatever, it's mm-hmm. just, ugh, it's so nauseating because they unfurl.
Yeah, and there are a number of different ones. They're all from the phylum Nematomorpha. And the way it works is this. The adults are free living, but the larvae are parasitic and grow to adulthood in the body of an insect. Male and female horsehair worms mate in damp soil and fresh water. So you may, if you're ever walking through the woods, which I was once, and I actually looked in a puddle and I saw one squirming around.
Really?
Yeah. So the males and the females, they mate in damp soil or fresh water. The female lays just millions of eggs in this little puddle. And then the eggs hatch and tiny larvae, They insist on vegetation near the water's edge.
Okay, which is probably likely to be eaten.
Right,
I'd assume.
Right. Yeah, that's what happens. Cricket or other host drops by. They eat the vegetation. They end up consuming the insisted larva. And in the case of, say, our carnivorous mantis, it acquires the parasite by devouring an intermediate host. So something else
okay.
eats the grass, and then the mantis eats it.
And that's another common theme we're going to see with some of these creatures today.
Yeah, yeah, because the parasite's playing kind of the long game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so once inside the final host, be it the thing that ate the plant or the thing that ate the thing that ate the plant, the cyst covering dissolves in the insect's gut, and it allows the juvenile worm to escape, bore through the gut wall, and start absorbing nutrients.
And that's, you know, similar to what we were just talking about with the guinea worm. That's when it bursts free, right? After it's sort of taken as many nutrients as it can?
Yeah, once it's reached full size. But here's the thing, and this is something that researchers are still exploring.
Okay.
So if the host dies, if somebody squashes it on a band room floor,
mm-hmm.
the worm emerges. But obviously this is a situation where spaceship cricket is going down. And so
yeah.
the parasite that is piloting the spaceship at this
Certainly.
Point has to get off, has to disembark. But remember how we talked about the puddle, right?
Yeah.
The puddle is where it needs to go.
Right. So it unlike the guinea worm, it doesn't encourage its host to go towards wet areas?
Well,
or is it they haven't
researchers
done
are
enough
still
research.
Trying to figure that out
okay.
because there are two possibilities. One, either the horsehair worm waits until its host inevitably returns to an area near water and then punches out through the abdomen, or it manipulates the host into seeking out water.
Okay, so this is again very much very vampiristic.
Yeah. And there's actually some compelling evidence toward the brain hacking situation, like observations of mantises jumping into the water, like, you know, lemming style.
You know, now that you're saying this, I do remember from Young's talk that he said that there's evidence that they release a certain kind of protein into the crickets' brains that addle their brains so that they head toward water.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, I feel like the evidence for brain hacking is pretty compelling here, and ultimately makes the creature all the more fascinating. Now, I know what you're wondering: can it infect humans?
Mm.
Well, yes, it can. They are human infections are possible, though not that likely. The human is not, of course, the intended host, but there were two Japanese cases reported in 2012, but these were due to, of course, just accidental ingestion of infected insects.
So these two humans had eaten a cricket or something like that, and that cricket had yet to burst its horsehair worm.
Yeah, I actually have a quote from the study here. It says, the woman vomited a worm after gargling with a saline solution as she felt something was caught in her throat while she was lying in bed. She had eaten vegetables harvested from a private garden. The other worm from the mouth of a boy was removed by his mother. So,
you said that you've seen these, so I'm assuming that they're indigenous to Southeast United States where we live. It sounds like they're also indigenous to Japan. Are they just everywhere?
I think they're just everywhere. Yeah,
okay.
They're in Asia, they're in Europe, they're in the United States, they're anywhere there is a warm, safe insect belly in which to grow. There you will find the horsehair worm, and maybe inside us.
Yeah,
think back to how well you washed your greens.
Well, it also makes me kind of wonder, right? Like, how many autopsy tables have somebody dies, and then all of a sudden a little worm just kind of pokes its way out and makes its way over to the sink or something, you know? I mean, I don't think that they're that insidious, obviously, but this is clearly where Del Toro got the inspiration from. Mm-hmm. There's one last creepy fact about the horsehair worm I want to throw in here. This is also from Young's talk. He said that there was a Japanese scientist named Takuya Sato who found one stream where there were so many of these things and they'd infected so many crickets that it just had filled up the stream with crickets, and over 60% of the local trout's diet were the crickets who had been infected by horsehair worms and then subsequently horsehair worms themselves.
Ah. I also remember reading in one of these articles that generally the host has only one horsehair worm inside it.
Okay.
But it is possible to wind up with twins where you have two of these things riding around inside you.
Wow. Okay.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend, or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, well, let's move on. What else do we have on the parasitic poo-poo bladder?
Well, we've got a zombie fungus here, and you seem familiar with this when we were first talking about this, but I believe it's pronounced Ophiocordyceps.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Cordyceps.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is also commonly known as the zombie fungus, and what I had heard was that down on the street, you know, they talk about the zombie fungus. I read about it. It drives carpenter ants, like, so that they get infected with this fungus, and carpenter ants then go to find a more suitable home for the fungus, and it bursts out. So, Young jokes about this in his talk. As you can already tell, the common theme is something gets in you, it drives you to go somewhere, and then it bursts out of your body and kills you. Now, you had some other research on these. There's more than one cordyceps.
Oh, yeah. Right? There are thousands of different cordyceps, and each one is aimed at a different insect species.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, though, bullet ants are infected by one particular type of cordyceps, and it manipulates the behavior of the ant. It causes it to climb up about 25 centimeters above the usual ant trail, usually facing northwest, clamp on with its jaws, generally around noon, and just not let go. And then within 6 hours, it dies. A few days later, a tube sprouts out of its head, and this is the fruiting body of the fungus. It, you know, blasts out the spores, and then these end up infecting new ants. So it makes the ant go raise itself up like a flag on a flagpole, die, and then spread its spores.
What's surely this seems very specific. Northwest at noon. What's the specific? There must be some kind of reason for that. Like, is the sun at its highest, and that subsequently makes it easier for the fungus to bloom or something? I don't know.
I guess so, or it's, you know, tapping into existing, you know, behavioral
maybe that's
in the ant. But generally what happens too in these social ant colonies is if they discover a worker that is exhibiting some of the characteristics of a cordyceps-infected ant, they'll remove them and take their body out and dump them somewhere else because they know that, that they are pariahs.
So they're like the vampire hunter ants?
Yeah. Yeah, like they are aware of the vampire issue, and they will remove them if there's something fishy.
Huh. This reminds me of the recent movie Ant-Man that's just come out, too, where apparently through some science, they just wear like Bluetooths, basically, in their ear that allows them to control ants. And now I'm wondering if they could backtrack and do a pseudoscience explanation of it by saying that they've infected these ants with the zombie fungus.
Well, you know, there are a lot of interesting species that live among ants. And one in particular I was reading about the other day is a type of beetle. And if you want the details on this, I did a Monster of the Week about The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
John Carpenter's The Thing, and I'll link to it on the
landing page.
That was
pretty recent, right?
Yeah. But in that, I tied in this particular beetle that lives among the ants, and it uses scent and audible cues to convince the other ants that it is either a worker ant or sometimes even royalty within the colony.
Wow.
So that it can live amongst the ants undetected, eat their larvae, and also benefit from the protection of the hive, because it's like living in a bank vault. You know, it's like living in a medieval castle in the insect world. You're pretty safe in there. And if you can get away with eating some of the babies in the castle, all the better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the insect world.
Ant-Man wasn't that dark, but I believe that they just said something very quickly about pheromones.
Yeah.
You know, that's usually just pheromones. That's how we do it. So what do we else? We have parasitic castration next.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yes. Because, of course, The Strain has some wonderful scenes where the characters who are changing suddenly realize that their genitals are rotting and or falling off. And then, whoops, they finally drop their pants, look in the mirror, and there is this Ken doll-like molding.
Yeah. As I mentioned at the top, it's like they get rid of everything that the vampire biology no longer needs, and it just falls off. I do remember this from the television show, that they made a rather big production about one character going through that process. And it was grisly.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. They've got the sort of action figure, Barbie doll body, and they're very smooth. Mm-hmm. So all that stuff falls off. So the parasitic castration is similar to this. Yes?
Yeah, and it's ghastly, but it's purely economical. Because in the case of The Strain, The little Strigoi worm, it doesn't need these host creatures to breed.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a part of its functional biology anymore. And so, in the natural world, we see parasitic castration as a tactic where they shut off reproduction in the host, generally in order to hoard all the energy resources for themselves.
Oh, okay.
Because this is your host. You're gaming this organism.
Mm.
And so any energy expenditure, and certainly in organisms, mating energy expenditures are kind of high. So if you can shut that off, then you've streamlined the energy efficiency of the organism for yourself. There are numerous accounts of this. But one that came to mind here is a parasitic barnacle called Sacculina carcini. And this parasite stops reproduction in the host crab and ends up stimulating the female crab to disperse parasitic eggs with the same behavior that she would normally use to lay her own eggs. So using the same mouth I don't know if they're mouth parts, but using the same her same physiological gifts to distribute the parasite young that she would normally use to distribute her own eggs.
You have a note here, too, about how trematode parasites also use this to destroy the gonads of their victims.
Yeah, because, again, what does it have gonads for?
This
is, you know, the parasite's essentially saying, this is not a free-roaming crab or insect. It's my car now, and my car does not need gonads.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to save this. There's a particular one that we're going to get to that I had a nightmare about last night. So we're heading towards it, though. The parasitic castration made me think about it. This is the first time working on an episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind I've had a nightmare. Well, welcome to the show, Christian.
Indeed.
So another one is, this is not the one I was thinking of, but the hookworm, which many of us are familiar with, or it's also called a nematode. You know, this is just your average hookworm parasite that sucks the blood from within its host. Very vampiric. It burrows into your skin and migrates to small intestines. And we're talking about humans here. I mean,
Especially in the South here. We were big on the hookworm until not too long ago.
Sometimes they can suck so much blood from within your body that you can get anemia. So you will probably be aware of this. And here is a stunning fact when I was looking this up. They currently infect 600 million people in the world. So that's a lot. I mean, when you think about it, you know, I was joking earlier about our sort of first world plumbing problems of having clean water that's readily available. But, man, 600 million people in the world are carrying around hookworms and can't do anything about it.
Well, then you have the interesting situation where hookworm-free individuals have sought them out. There's been some interesting content to come out in previous years about this, where there's the argument that humans have had hookworms for so long that we've kind of co-evolved with them.
Okay.
And we've reached the point where we kind of don't work right if we're missing the hookworms.
Really?
So you have, you've had cases where certain individuals have claimed that as hookworm-free organisms, they don't work right. They're not functioning properly. They have all these allergies, et cetera.
IBS or some kind of modern malady.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times it is just excessive allergies.
Okay.
And then they seek out the hookworm infection.
Yeah.
And acquire hookworms by saying going to a latrine field in Africa. There was a This American Life about this one individual, British individual who did this.
Really?
I think he was British, or he ended up fleeing to Britain. Anyway, he went and acquired hookworms, and he was actually selling them online for a little bit to like-minded individuals.
Interesting.
The thing is, he's kind of acting ahead of the research. There's actual research that's looking into this, saying, you know, to what extent do we benefit from a mild hookworm infestation in our bodies? You know, not enough to actually cause anemia, but enough to sort of balance things out and give our body the level of infection and occupancy that it has come to expect.
So it's sort of like the symbiotic relationship many animals have with parasites have with their hosts.
Yeah,
I mean,
across the board, when you look at parasites and symbiotic relationships, there's often kind of that gray area. Like, when does a parasite stop being a parasite and start becoming a symbiotic organism? At what point does it stop becoming a parasite and become a part of who you are, such as, you know, all the bacteria in our bodies?
Yeah, like, I'm thinking of lampreys. Where I grew up in New England, lampreys are really common in the rivers around there. And they certainly work off of hosts and kind of, you know, to maintain one another's ecology. But there's also I'm forgetting the name right now, but the fish that clean sharks.
Oh.
Remoras?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, the little cleaning organs.
Yeah. Maybe the hookworm is our remora.
Yeah, I mean, I've read some interesting, speculative, biology about the origins of the vampire bat.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some theories that vampire bats originated as creatures that would feed, clean up the wounds of giant, you know, megafauna.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time that develops into just full-blown parasitism.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, if your stomach hasn't turned yet from our hookworms and syphilis and zombie fungus, what have we got next for you that's like a vampire from a science fiction TV show?
Of course, we could keep going. We're actually going to have to cut a couple of parasites from our notes so that we don't go too long here. But the next one we're going to look at is Cymathoa exigua, which is this cool isopod creature that a number of you are probably familiar with. It kind of looks like a sand louse.
A little bit like a kind of beetle or an enlarged tick or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's actually kin to like the little roly-poly creatures you see.
Mm-hmm. If you've seen the horror movie The Bay, which came out about 2, maybe 3 years ago, the whole movie surrounded the idea of these sort of mutated isopods infecting human beings.
Oh, did you see it?
I did, yeah.
Does it actually, like, replace their tongue?
Yeah.
It does?
Yeah, the whole movie sort of builds up to that. That's the big scene. But they cut it. It's found footage, so they cut it with footage of actual isopods inside fish mouths replacing their tongues.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with this one because I think we've covered it on the podcast before. And it's also one of these things that just really became viral because it's horrifying.
Yeah.
This idea that you look in this fish's mouth, and there, instead of the fish's tongue, you have this little crustacean that is just sitting there, perched on the on its tongue stump, acting as its tongue.
Just like, you know, you open this mouth and there's a little guy and there's, hello.
Yeah. Yeah, there, I think there's some lovely cartoons out there where they explore that.
This is, so I mentioned earlier, I had a nightmare doing the research for this episode. And this was, I think it was sort of an amalgamation of all the parasites that we're talking about here. But the isopod in particular is one that gets me. Before I went to bed last night, my throat was a little inflamed. I think like my allergies were bothering me. Mm-hmm. And in the night, I had this, you know, horrifying nightmare about something crawling around in my throat. It was probably mixed in with the strain as well, with the, you know, the whole idea that your voice box and lungs collapse and fuse into the stinger thing. But the isopod is really, I mean, that's pretty close to the strain there where your tongue is replaced by a living thing.
Yeah. And it's horrifying to think of a fish experiencing this because the fish can't just reach in and do anything about
right.
it. It's just kind of, it's just got to roll with it at this point. This thing painfully like drains your tongue juice out and then your, it just atrophies and then attaches to the stump and then it becomes your new tongue and you know, feeding off of morsels of food and mucus. It's horrifying.
Yeah, and to be clear here, my understanding is that they do not do this to humans. There hasn't been a case where a human's tongue has been replaced by one of these things.
Right.
But
and
that movie exists. It's fictional.
Yeah, and the isopods in question here, it's my understanding, too, that we still need a lot more research on them. There isn't a lot of study into their biology, and their life cycle, but hopefully in the years to come we'll learn more about their marvelous lifestyle.
But yeah, if you want to see some twitchy imagery, do an image search for isopods, because just in general, not even just the ones the cymothia as you mentioned earlier, they're creepy. There's something about them that just doesn't work for me. Okay. Wasps, there are a lot of different parasitic wasps. So this is sort of a broad category, but I think it's important for us to cover in this relation to the strain because there's so many of them, but they commonly have, this trait where they lay eggs inside of a host. The generic one that I read about was that they lay eggs inside a caterpillar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these eggs hatch inside the caterpillar's body, devour it from the inside out, and then burst out of its body again, like the stereotype of all these things, right? Here's where it gets even weirder. Some of these wasps stay behind in the corpse of this caterpillar to defend other wasps that are still metamorphosizing inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they will, like people wearing a horse costume, sort of, they manipulate the caterpillar's corpse so it seems like it's still alive, and they try to chase away predators. They'll move it and kind of twitch it around, and it's horrifying.
Yeah, when you start looking at parasitic wasps, there's so many fabulous examples. Like, there's a study that I was just reading, an embargoed study that's coming out and will have come out by the time this episode airs, in which a particular wasp actually makes the infected spiders build a protection for it.
Yeah.
And one of my favorites is a particular wasp, Deinocampus coccinella. And it does the traditional parasitic setup here. It ambushes a ladybug, implants its egg inside it, and then runs off, right? So eventually the young wasp emerges from the host organism.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times you would expect the host organism to mercifully die off. But in this case, not only does the ladybug live, but a little behavior modification from the parasite forces it to hang around and guard the parasite baby as it grows into full adulthood beneath the protective bulk of the ladybug.
Yeah.
And they think it's due to secretions that are left by the larva when it bursts out that, you know, functionally reprogram it. And then on top of that, the ladybug doesn't even die then. The researchers found that in 25% of the cases, the ladybugs recovered normal behavior following the ordeal.
Really?
Yeah.
So this is really gets to the heart of that theme of taking away independence,
mm-hmm.
these parasitic organisms doing so, but also that it gains it back. It gets its life back afterwards.
That's so, well, I mean, it has
nice.
This hole in it, I guess. I can't help but imagine like a human scenario. Like, yeah. What if we lived in a world where occasionally you're just impregnated by a parasite and you essentially give birth to this thing as it emerges from you, you know, alien chest burster style, but then you live on to, you know, go to support groups for likewise parasite-afflicted individuals.
Well, I mean, I suppose that you could argue that that's what's going on with some people of hookworm or tapeworm and such, but they're not reprogrammed to guard the tapeworm's lair. You know, there's another, just one more parasitic wasp that I wanted to touch on here, the Ampulex compressa, which is the emerald cockroach wasp.
Ooh.
This one does a similar thing that for the ladybug, but it's with cockroaches. I like that they all have their own, like specific breed of other insect that they, you know, mind control and destroy. Mm-hmm. So this one lands on a cockroach, stabs it when it's fertilized with eggs, the wasp. The stinger that it stabs it with is also a sense organ, so it kind of roots around inside the cockroach and touches its brain. And it injects a certain kind of venom into the cockroach's brain that basically takes away the cockroach's motivation to escape danger at all. So the cockroach becomes placid and just follows this wasp.
Well, that's a gift, really, right?
Yeah, I mean, taking away, you know, fear.
Yeah.
So, you know, they give, they take, but... this is where it gets really nasty. It leads the cockroach away from where it lives back to the wasp's lair, lays the eggs in it, and then what do you think happens?
Everyone goes their separate ways?
Unfortunately, no. wasp eggs hatch and burst out of the cockroach and kill it. So a lot of bursting, more bursting.
It's a beautiful world. Beautiful parasitic world.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, we're specifically trying to associate these with the vampires from The Strain, but I would say that a lot of these resonate with the xenomorph from Alien.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's very, very parasitic in that regard.
And the crazy thing is, like, as elaborate as the Strigoi life cycle is, as elaborate as the xenomorph life cycle is, you look at some of the charts showing you various parasitic life cycles and all the different hosts they have to go through. And some of these are tremendously complex. Like, you could never do a TV show about them because everyone would have to keep referring to, you know, flashcards to keep up with the life cycle.
Especially when you get these ones, which we didn't cover that much here, but the ones that go from one host to another host to another host. Mm-hmm. So their ultimate end goal, for instance, is like a flamingo, but they get eaten by a cricket or something first. And then they're inside the cricket and then the cricket's eaten by a flamingo or something like that. You know, they move on and on and on to get to the eventual thing that they can reproduce in.
Yeah. And then very often they're hacking the mind of the host. They're manipulating behavior in order to game it back towards that start point or that end point.
Right. Exactly.
All right. So there you have it. The Strain, the world of parasites, and I'll make sure that the landing page for this episode includes links to a whole bunch of stuff to blow your mind content about parasites and their wonderful ways.
Yeah, I was going to say this research really, I think, is in the golden zone for stuff to blow your mind. There's a lot of previous episodes and videos and posts that you've done over the years on this, and you know, I would love to hear from our listeners as well about their experience with these things, whether, you know, maybe there's somebody out there who's had hookworm, or maybe there's somebody who's had experience researching these things and could tell us more about them. It really is stuff we're going to just keep on covering because it's fascinating and there's always more research coming
out about
it. Yeah,
they're continually finding cool new parasites and new understandings of how existent parasites work.
So if you want to tell us your stories about these, you can contact us on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr, where we are Blow the Mind. Or you can write to us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.